Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the chief executive of the Guide Association, Julie Bentley, or more accurately, Girl Guiding. The name change a clue, surely, to the evolving nature of an organisation determined to be relevant and useful to girls in the 21st century. Indeed, being relevant and useful is pretty much how my castaway has spent her entire working life. From her early efforts at an HIV charity to running the Family Planning Association, she says her passion lies with helping young people develop confidence and direction. Never a brownie or a girl guide herself, she was brought up in what she describes as a happy working class family in Essex, and it took her a little while to find her own self-assurance and sense of purpose. A painfully shy little kid who was bullied at primary, she later went on to be head girl, but left school with very few qualifications. In her 30s, she used a bequest from her mother to fund her master's degree. She says of the Girl Guides, "It's not about itchy brown uniforms and sewing and baking. It is a modern, contemporary, vibrant organisation." And so, Julie Bentley, both personally and professionally, it seems to me that you are very big on relevance. Is it important to you that things have a sort of practical, life-enhancing force behind them?
Yes, it really is. Many years ago, I reached the conclusion that what I really, really wanted to do was to work with young people. And more importantly, I wanted to work in the not-for-profit sector because I was brought up with a really very strong sense of personal responsibility, but also responsibility to the wider world. And, you know, I have sometimes faced some criticism for some of my choices, you know, working in the field of drug and alcohol addiction, working in the field of sexual health. But actually, you know, I was brought up with a very, very strong moral compass, which said to me that you don't turn your back on people because they're vulnerable or because they've got problems. And you certainly don't turn your back on people who are being discriminated against. What you do is you stand by those people and do what you can.
And so baking and backstitch then, that's what it was about when I was a girl guide 30 years ago. It's not about that anymore. That doesn't have a place, does it?
There's still some baking. There's still some stitching. You know, never say never to anything, frankly. But one of the things that I have actually discovered since taking up the post at Girl Guiding is that this organisation is incredibly relevant. Over 100 years, Girl Guiding's been going, and in that time, it has evolved. And as the lives and needs and aspirations of girls and young women have changed, so has Girl Guiding changed in order to meet the needs of those girls and young women.
You made headlines when you were appointed at the Girl Guide Association a few years back. One of the reasons was because you called it the ultimate feminist organisation. You said the F word, which, of course, a lot of people get their knickers in a knot about. It's an organisation obviously specifically for girls, but why then is it the ultimate feminist organisation?
The first thing to say is, what do I mean when I say the word feminist? Because actually, I think many people see it as a hugely negative word. When I say I'm a feminist, all I mean by that is that I believe that there should be parity between men and women, socially, politically, and economically. And, you know, some people like to interpret this as, you know, she hates men or she's angry with the world. I'm actually pretty happy with the world and actually really love men. But the fact remains that we still don't have that parity between men and women, and therefore the job isn't done, and it isn't time to stop talking about that yet.
You were named by Women's Hour early in the year as one of Britain's game changers. People who make a difference, who shift policy, that stuff of changing the world, of incrementally moving things on, takes a heck of a lot of energy. Do your spirits ever flag?
Of course. Doesn't everybody sometimes have those days where their spirits flag? But I really do have a strong sense of, you know, we have one life and, you know, I need to be the best person that I can be. And I know that sounds cheesy, I guess, but I really do think that. And, you know, sometimes I get credited with, you know, Julie Bentley's made Girl Guiding cool. And I haven't done that. I've only been there 2 years. What I have done is very, very proudly shine a spotlight on this incredible charity. It is a phenomenal organisation.
Let's go to the music, Julie Bentley. Tell me about your first disc this morning. What is it and why have you chosen it?
So my first disc this morning is Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves. And this was in the charts when I was about 16 years old. But at the time, I didn't understand what feminism was. I don't think I'd even heard of it. But actually this song, which very powerfully said, women don't have to always just be behind a man for success. They can be successful in their own right, was something that really resonated with me. And I really took away from that, OK, there is all sorts of potential. And it's just a really cracking tune, isn't it?
That was Aretha Franklin and the Eurythmics, and Sisters Are Doing It For Themselves. There's a sense in which, Julie Bentley, the media representations of young people, both boys and girls, constantly tell us that they seem to be in a state of crisis right now. You know, there are more youngsters taking antidepressants, there are more youngsters, both boys and girls, with eating disorders, and so on and so on. When you're out there meeting your guides, what do they seem like to you?
Well, they're a very varied group of people. You know, we've got over 500,000 members, so, you know, there's a lot of difference. But actually, one of the regular narratives that we do hear is the pressure that they feel in terms of what they're meant to look like and what they're meant to behave like. You know, when I was a child, I loved playing with my Pippa dolls, but I also really, really loved being Robin Hood, playing with my bow and arrow that my mum made me. And both of those things were perfectly fine. Increasingly, it feels like actually our children and our young people are being more pigeonholed based on their gender about what a girl is meant to be like. So I think we've got a lot of work to do.
Recently, you decided within the organisation to survey your 16 to 25 year old membership, and you asked them about the subject of this campaign called No More Page 3. And how many of them said that they would agree to sign up to that campaign?
88% of respondents said they thought we should sign up.
Right, OK. Now, politics and sexual politics with a small p. Some people might be made rather uncomfortable with the idea that guiding gets involved in that sort of area. They might say, in a way, you're almost asking them to think about things that are not about what the purity of guiding should be about. How would you reply to that?
I would say what guiding is about is what is relevant to girls and young women today. And actually, this is how the society is. And our girls and young women are very aware of these issues. So we're not exposing them to things they aren't aware of. What we're doing is we're creating a safe space for them to talk about them and express their views about them.
If you were signing up to be a guide right now, what badges would you go for?
Well, actually, I probably could do the baking badge because I'm pretty rubbish at cooking and I can't sew either. But I would certainly have signed up when I was younger to the body confidence badge, I think. And also we have a badge called Be the Change, which is about helping girls and young women understand about having a voice and how to articulate that voice. So I think that would have been helpful.
You don't
me.
Need that badge.
Well, I don't need it now, but certainly when I was a child, I was painfully shy.
Tell me about your second disc then, Julie.
So the second disc is Eminem, Lose Yourself. And the narrative is around somebody who comes from a place which was very difficult, but having some potential and seeing an opportunity and going for it. I grew up in a very working class family. It was quite a poor family. I was very unsuccessful academically at school. I wasn't expected to be professionally successful, but I had an incredibly loving family system around me. You know, the messages I got as a child was, do your best. That's all anybody can ask of you. And if actually your best at school isn't that brilliant, that's okay as long as you've tried really hard. And those things, coupled with having a really great couple of role models through my early career, have really helped me to move from that place of being a very, very shy, not very bright child to being the adult I am now.
That was Eminem and Lose Yourself. So tell me more then, Julie Bentley, about, as you describe it, this happy working class family in Essex. What did your parents do for a living?
Before I was born, they run their own taxi company. Yeah. I have seen some great photos of my brother and sister who are both quite a lot older than me. actually probably health and safety probably wouldn't allow it now on reflection, but they were both sat on top of my parents' taxis in the local carnival procession. But when I was growing up, my mum was a cleaning lady and my dad was a manual labourer.
And you've described your mother as an emotionally literate person. I think that's a great phrase and I'm very interested in it. Tell me more about this mother of yours.
So my mum was, for a period of my childhood, my parents were separated. So I was brought up pretty much in a single parent family. And my mum was an incredible woman. She wasn't educated. She wasn't academically bright, but she was incredibly bright in life. And she dealt with having an incredibly shy little girl on her hands with a huge amount of compassion, but also with a really good balance of determination that this wasn't going to define who I was.
It's difficult for people to understand. It's always interesting to speak to people who've been really shy as kids. Can you describe to me a bit more what that felt like? What does it feel to be a shy kid?
I just recall feeling like just a little bit scared of the world around me and just always feeling at my happiest when I was next to my mum, or actually next to my big sister as well. And I've been asked many times why I wasn't in the guides. And actually, the thought for me, I was so shy, the thought of going and taking part in something like that would have been very, very scary.
And I read that your dad lost his job in his early 50s, which strikes me as a particularly cruel time, both practically and emotionally, to lose your job. Do you remember the impact of that on the family?
The thing that I remember most was his absolute determination to get another job. He would leave the house every day and he would walk for miles and miles and miles, and he would go in every shop, every factory, and he did that until he got a job.
And were you aware of, I'm sure there must have been very significant money worries. Some families are pretty open about that and some families protect their kids from that. What was your parents' approach?
I was aware of that. We were a very, very open family.
Were you?
Communication was very, very open between us about any
You're
subject.
You're smiling when you say that.
I'm smiling because, yeah, any subject is up for grabs within my family system. So, yes, I was very aware of it. And, of course, you know, we were fortunate that my brother and sister, being so much older, were both earning.
Time for your third. Tell me about this.
My third song is Tiger Feet by Mudd. And this is a homage, really, to my big brother and sister. My sister's 11 years older than me and my brother's 13 years older. And so I was brought up really on a diet of their music. But they used to dance to this song. And they danced to this song so much that they actually wore holes in our carpet in the living room, which my mum wasn't very impressed about, actually. So cute that you love should be. Oh, well, now you've been laying it down. You got your hips swinging out of bounds. And I like the way you do what you do to me.
That was Mud and Tiger Feet and Memories, Julie Bentley, of your big brother and big sister, much older than you and wearing a hole in the carpet in the sitting room dancing to that. Your big brother gave you good advice, I understand, about being bullied at school because you got it in the neck from the bullies. What did he tell you to do to deal with them?
His advice when I would come home from primary school upset because someone had been unkind to me would be, if there's more than one of them, stand with your back against the wall because then you can deal with them one by one. I'm not quite sure what he thought I was going to do to deal with them one by one, given I was incredibly shy.
Now, putting together the jigsaw pieces of somebody's life is sort of what I try to do when I talk to them. And there you are, you know, a shy little girl who's sort of hanging behind her mother's skirt and never really comfortable unless she's with her big brother and her big sister and her mum. She's head girl at 17. And now there's a big missing chunk right in the middle there that I just want to know about. What happened?
Oh, do you know what? I'm really not sure. So by the time I was in my teenage years, I had formed a lot of really good friendships.
Right.
So I was much happier and I had more confidence and I wasn't as painfully shy, although I was still quite insecure. And you have to put yourself forward for head girl. And I had to stand up in front of the sixth form and make a speech about why I wanted to be head girl. And I was chosen, which was a total shock. And I went home and said to Mum, I'm going to be the head girl. And she was totally shocked as well. But actually, I think that experience was one of the pivotal moments for me, because what it did, it evoked in me a sense of, actually, I think something's important and I think I probably should step forward. And as I went through that year, which was a brilliant year. I mean, I was academically useless, but I was a really good head girl. You know, we did great charity stuff and it was great fun. I found confidence in that year. And I also realised that I was good at something and that other people saw good in me. And I don't think that had occurred to me before.
Let's hear your fourth. Tell me about this.
I was a teenager of the 80s. I was very much into my pop music. And I've chosen this next song because Frankie Goes to Hollywood were so different when they came onto the scene from anything we were hearing. And so whilst I have some great memories from the 80s altogether as a teenager, some terrible fashion choices when I think back to what I was wearing, for me, this song kind of summed up that sense of, wow, this is new and nobody else knows what this feels like. And of course, quite a lot of adults disapproved, which is always very exciting to a teenager.
That was Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. I should tell our listeners, Julie Bentley, that during that we were swapping tales of boiler suits and perms and Deirdre Barlow glasses. We don't have time for all of that, but you did conjure a wonderful image. And let's talk about your first job then as an apprentice police photographic technician, to give it its full title. You were 18 when you left school and got that job. Tell me about your first few days in work. How did it go?
Well, it wasn't the best first few days in work. In the interview, one of the questions they asked me was if I was squeamish. And I didn't consider myself to be squeamish, so said no. But it became very clear very quickly that this was beyond squeamish because I was exposed to the most horrific of images. You know, people that had died in car crashes, people that had killed themselves, children that had been starved to death. And I think I knew on my very first day that I had made a terrible mistake because I was actually physically sick. And I said, you know, I really don't want to be a person that can see these images and not feel physically sick at them. So I resigned and actually left without another job to go to.
Was that the time also that your father passed away?
My dad died 2 days after I left that job.
2 days after?
Yeah.
So how did you, I mean, a very, you know, we're young, we're 18, we're full of optimism. How did you deal with such horrendous circumstances of your father passing away?
Well, obviously, it was a very difficult time. Dad died very, very suddenly and very unexpectedly, just literally dropped down dead of a heart attack at work. So there was no warning. What I did was I decided I needed to get a job quickly to help with family finances. And so I just did, I suppose I took the example of what my dad had done, which was I started to walk around looking for places that had jobs, and the local post office was advertising for postmen at the time. Mm. And so I applied and got a job as a postie, and I loved it. It was a very social job, and I had the same post around for 5 years, and I learned quite a lot about people in that job. Some people did look down on me because I was just the person delivering the post. Mm-hmm. And they made lots of assumptions about me that I must be really quite thick, and obviously I couldn't get another job if I was a postie. But I also met some amazing people, and if it was pouring with rain and I was drenched through to my undies, I'd have, you know, Mrs. X waiting for me at the front door with a cup of tea, you know, saying, "You look perishing, love, you know, have some tea before you go on." So actually I saw some real kindness.
Let's have some more music, Julie Bentley. We're on your fifth.
The next song is a reminder of my first full paid youth work role. As a post lady, I had decided that I wanted to be a youth worker. So I started to do lots of volunteering in my hometown and then eventually applied for my first full-time job as a youth worker. And it was in South East London. It was a bit of a shock to the system, frankly, because I came from quite a nice twee little rural place in Essex. I hadn't seen the level of deprivation and disadvantage. And we developed a project working with young people around drug and alcohol issues. And one of the songs that we used to use to help kind of prompt their thinking was this song, which is White Lines by Grandmaster Flash. Lots of people think this is a song promoting drug use, but actually it isn't. And whenever I hear this song, it really reminds me of being a 24-year-old youth worker in a really tough part of London and about what I learned about different life experiences at that time.
Vision, dreams of passion, and all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do.
Something like a phenomenon.
Baby.
Tell your body to come along. But white lights blow away.
Grandmaster Flash and White Lines. There is an increasing awareness, Julie Bentley, of the particular problems that teenagers face. We're increasingly aware that youngsters at those vulnerable stages in their lives are targeted by potential abusers, it could be drug users and so on and so on. As somebody who's worked in the field and who sees things changing now, what do you make of all those years when lots of people in positions of authority and responsibility who were supposed to be there to help children appeared not to want to know and swept it under the carpet?
I think it's very difficult, and I think we are far more acutely aware of some of the risks to young people in a way that wasn't the case many, many years ago. I mean, the world has changed so hugely, hasn't it? You know, when I was a teenager, there wasn't even a mobile phone, let alone internet and social media. So what we have to do now is focus on how we adapt the support that young people get. One of the things that I've often been challenged for in the past is my support for sex and relationships education, for example. But actually, you know, information is a thing that helps us. And we need to make sure that our young people have the information that they need in order to understand how they need to protect themselves in terms of all walks of life.
Do you think it's the case that we just need to abandon ideas of innocence? Because I might think back to when I was 12 or you were 12 and think, well, we just didn't know about those things. Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't talk to kids about those things, if they were children for just a little bit longer? Do you think we need to forget that?
That notion of, you know, by talking to young people about the realities of some things, you are taking away their innocence. That presumes that young people didn't know about and weren't aware of the things. The fact is, most young people are aware of a degree of life in the big wide world that we certainly weren't.
I mean, we can't hold back that tide.
The fact is, they know, you know. So, you know, when I was a teenager, I wasn't aware of pornography. Actually, pornography, regretfully, is so easily accessible nowadays on social media. And so my view on this is, it isn't going to help them by pretending it's not there. If they're accessing it and seeing it, then we have a responsibility to help them understand that that is not a true representation of a relationship between two people.
Let's just wind back a bit from that then. When did you first realise that sexual health was an area you wanted to work in and it needed to be addressed?
I first became aware of the whole area of sexual health when I was in my late teens, and I volunteered with a charity in Essex that supported people that were HIV positive. And obviously back then, you know, HIV was big news, and it was the time when, you know, it was very scary as well, the big tombstone advertisements, etc.
Yeah, and it was stigmatised highly as
incredibly,
the gay plague and so on.
Incredibly stigmatised. Yes. And I volunteered as a buddy supporting an HIV positive woman. And that really opened my eyes both to the challenges of sexual health, but also to that issue of stigma and discrimination. And I think, you know, probably that led to me being interested in the Family Planning Association.
Many years later, when you ran that organisation, you headed up notable campaigns to do with disabled people having fulfilling sex lives and that to be a reasonable expectation of a healthy life of a disabled person. You also spoke about the increase in sexually transmitted diseases for the over 60s. Both of these campaigns received a, you know, a lot of publicity, and you went out batting for them. It strikes me you, somewhere along the way, you stopped being shy. if you can sit in a radio or a TV studio and talk about those things, you know, which British people can often find rather squirming.
Yes. Yeah, I guess so. Although you noticed earlier, I was chuckling when I referred to the fact that there was no subject was off limits when my family system, and sex was one of those. My mum had a fantastic approach to sex education, which was, if I asked a question, she answered it straightforwardly and honestly. So I grew up with the expectation that, you know, of course, sensible grown-up, mature people talk about sex in a sensible, mature way. And then I got out into the real world and realised that wasn't always the case. One headline once said, teaches five-year-olds to put on condoms, which, of course, is ridiculous. That is never what happened. But actually, some of the things that we did, as you mentioned, I'm very, very proud of.
Time for some more music. You're sixth.
The next song is about Sean, my partner. We had our wedding 9 years ago, and we asked our guests to suggest a song that they felt summed our relationship up. And I have to say, it was brilliant. We had some fantastic song suggestions. But we chose this one, Queen, You're My Best Friend. And so we had this song playing as we walked back down the garden path, which was our version of the aisle. And it's absolutely true. Sean is my very best friend.
Ooh, you make me live now, honey. Ooh, you make me live. Oh, you
was You're My Best Friend by Queen. Julie, as we know then, you run this organisation with thousands of teenage members. How much time do you actually spend in their company?
I try and get out to visit our units and our events and our activities as much as possible. It never feels like work when I'm out visiting the girls and the units. And one of the first things I did when I took up the post was I went along to our big gig. And it's a gig just for girl guides, with all of the top pop bands. And we filled Wembley twice over in one day. And my colleague said, OK, Julie, just stand here and we're going to open the doors in a minute. And I stood in the pit and they opened the doors and from every direction, Wembley filled up with nothing but girl guides. And the noise was phenomenal. And actually, it brought a tear to my eye because I just stood and looked at this incredible sight of these girls having the most fantastic time and thought, and this is just a tiny, tiny percentage of the girls and young women that we reach through girl guiding.
You don't have kids yourself, and I'm wondering if being able to go home and shut the door and have peace and quiet away from all of the demands is actually something of a relief for you.
Well, I think having a bit of peace and quiet is a relief for everybody.
Yeah, but not everybody gets it, especially the teenage kids.
I don't feel like I get much peace and quiet.
Do you not?
That's mainly because I choose to have a life that involves a lot of being at work. But home is my sanctuary, actually. And one of my very favourite things to do is to actually just come home and sit on the sofa in my PJs with Sean and a cup of tea.
I'm glad to hear that you do that, because I read that to celebrate your 40th birthday, you and Sean went, you didn't put your feet up, you decided to cycle from Land's End to John O'Groats. And I'm wondering, to what extent was that a sort of test of your relationship as well as your physical ability?
15 days together, just the two of you on your bikes, was a high risk scenario for mm-hmm. any relationship. But I'm very pleased to report that our relationship endured and proved to be very resilient. And thankfully, in the peaks and troughs of the emotional roller coaster that is cycling from Land's End to John O'Groats, because trust me, it is a huge
yes.
emotional roller coaster, we saw each other through it.
I mentioned in the introduction that you funded your master's degree in your 30s by a legacy left by your mother in her will.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think she would have made by the use of the money?
Oh, she would have been absolutely delighted. Well, she wouldn't have known what an MBA was, actually, in all honesty. But once she had understood what it was, she would have been very, very proud of that.
Tell me about your next choice then.
So my next choice is dedicated to my mum. My mum died 14 years ago, and she was very ill with cancer for a few years before she died, which was a very difficult time, but it was a huge privilege to have that time with her. But because she knew she was dying, she decided that she wanted to plan her funeral, because that's where I get my organisation skills from. Very organised, the Bentley women. And she said, I really want this song played at my funeral. And the song is, I Believe, by Harry Secombe. So I went off to find the song and couldn't find it anywhere. And so I wrote to Harry Secombe and, extraordinary, I got a reply. And he said, your mum's right. She did hear me singing the song, but I haven't actually recorded it. But I hope the enclosed is helpful. And in the package was an old cassette tape of him singing the song. And so I went to mum and she was just beside herself, because firstly, she was beside herself that I would write to Sir Harry Secombe. I mean, that's not the sort of thing we did in our family, write to celebrities. but even more, of course, taken aback by the fact that there had been a response. So it was very poignant at her funeral when the song was played. And I still have that old tape.
That was Harry Secombe and I Believe. As we know then from talking to you this morning, you've worked with people who are HIV positive, you've worked with alcohol and drug abusers, you've promoted better sexual health. I'm wondering now if heading up the Girl Guides is in a way, although it doesn't really in the beginning seem like it, but somehow part of that continuum, the idea that if you can get youngsters and engage them and offer them alternatives to all of the sort of less salubrious things that are out there, that actually you might be helping to stop the problem before it even begins.
Well, I think there might be a degree of that. The thing is, often the narrative around young people is a negative narrative. You see far more stories about young people that are negative stories than you see about young people that are positive. Actually, the fact of the matter is, most young people are fantastic. And, you know, it's a real privilege to be able to work with the next generation.
I know you camped a lot as a family. Yes. Went on camping holidays. I don't know if you've got your advanced camper badge, which is available, I learned, from the guiding website. How do you think you might survive on the desert island?
Practically, probably not that well, thinking about it. But actually, I don't think I'd survive very well on the desert island in general, because I'm not very good at being isolated. I think I would be very lonely. But I am a bit of a sun worshipper, so as long as it could be an island that had a nice beach and lots of sunshine, then I might be okay for a little while. But if possible, I'd like to be brought back from it quite quickly.
We'll see what we can do, but I'm not guaranteeing anything. Tell me about your final piece of music then, Julie.
My final song is 500 Miles by Sonny and Cher. A version of this song was used as a theme tune to the iconic film Kathy Come Home, which, following that film, the charity Shelter was started. I became a trustee of Shelter because when I worked with people with drug and alcohol addictions in my earlier career, many of those people were homeless as a result of their problems. And for me, it is impossible to flourish in an environment like that. So the work of Shelter is absolutely crucial, and I'm incredibly proud to be a trustee of the organisation.
Sonny and Cher and 500 Miles. I'm about to cast you away then, Julie Bentley, as we know. You get to take the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare and one other book too. What's it going to be?
It's going to be If Nobody Speaks of Remarkable Things by John McGregor.
Right, that's yours and a luxury.
I am going to take my photo albums because actually, you know, my family and my friends are the world to me. And if I've got to be there on my own, then I at least need to be able to look at their lovely faces frequently.
Right. That's yours then. And finally, if you could only have one of these eight tracks, which one disc would it be?
It would have to be You're My Best Friend, so that I could keep Sean close.
It's yours. Julie Bentley, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.